The Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Virginia.
Welcome to this virtual session of the Supreme Court of Virginia. I am Chief Justice S. Bernard Goodwin. The other justices of the court are also present, with Senior Justice Lawrence Koontz sitting for Justice Donald Lemons. The audio of this virtual session is being live streamed on a link which can be accessed at vacourts.gov. Welcome, everyone. Ms. Clerk, please call the first case.
California Condominium Association versus Peterson, Joseph R. Mays, Appellant's Counsel, David L. Little, Appellee's Counsel.
Mr. Mays, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Joseph Mays with the firm of Williams Mullen, and I represent the appellant in this case, California Condominium Association. I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
The condominium has 24 units, and this action seeks to recover special assessments on two of the four units owned by Mr. Peterson. The assessments were imposed in 2006 and were for the expenses of maintenance and repair of the common elements. The original complaint was filed on June 20, 2017, and was met with a plea and bar based on the 3-year statute of limitations. The hearing on the plea and bar was held by the trial court under 8.01-336B. This appeal focuses on a claim not decided by the trial court under the declaration for the condominium, which did not accrue until August 18, 2016, when Mr. Peterson and his ex-wife conveyed the four units they owned to Mr. Peterson individually.
Mr. Mays, this is Justice Cascade. If I may interrupt you with a question, are you asking on your theory of the case for a remand, or are you asking us for a final judgment in your favor? Because it appears the brief suggests the latter.
Justice Kelsey, I'm going to apologize for if I overstep my bounds in the brief. I am asking for a remand, and the reason that I went ahead and asked for judgment was that, so far as I know, there are no other matters of defense. If by doing so I overstep my bounds, then I apologize and hope to have you consider the brief appropriately amended.
Fair enough. Thank you.
The declaration in this case requires that upon sale or conveyance of a unit, any unpaid assessments for maintenance and repair of the common elements be paid out of the sale proceeds or by the purchaser, in this case, Mr. Peterson. Most of the exhibits that are pertinent to that issue, the declaration and the bylaws, the settlement statement, and the deed of the parties actually conveying the units, were all attachments to the complaint. They were all admitted as well. In its pre-hearing memorandum and post-hearing memorandum, the association recited the facts established by the exhibits and the basis for their authenticity, either as exhibits to the complaint under Rule 1:4I, testate copies of court documents, admissions that were conclusively established, or certified business records under the appropriate statute. In its written opinion, the trial court sustained the plea and bar, ruling that the request for admission of exhibits came too late and would require another hearing to allow for objections to authenticity. It did not consider at all the claim on the declaration. The association filed a motion for reconsideration, reciting all the bases for the authenticity of the exhibits. It was overruled. There are two assignments of error here. The trial court abused its discretion when it excluded the exhibits and overruled the motion for reconsideration. The trial court erred when it sustained the plea and bar to the association's claim under the declaration. Now, Mr. Peterson bears the burden of proof here. He must show by a preponderance of the evidence that the cause of action arose prior to the statutory period before the action was instituted. And we contend that he has not done so. The court has repeatedly said that a trial court, by definition, abuses its discretion when it makes an error of law. The abuse of discretion standard includes review to determine that the discretion was not guided by erroneous legal conclusions. How did the trial court abuse its discretion in this case? First, by ignoring the clear basis for the authenticity of all of the association's exhibits.
Mr. Mays, this is Justice Kelsey again. I'm sorry to interrupt again, but I wonder if you're making this argument too hard on yourself, because the admissibility of exhibits is not the same thing as the admission of exhibits. And that's all Judge Croshaw said. But this is a plea and bar, as you said, and a plea and bar can either be on the pleadings, accepting the pleadings at face value and still assert a claim, or it can be ori tenens. And your case happens to be one of the unusual cases where there were theories of plea and bar that required ori tenens, and there were one theory that we're not talking about, that could be resolved entirely on the pleadings. So do we really need to get into the distinction between admissibility and admittance with these exhibits when we're dealing with documents that were incorporated by reference into the pleadings, and we're dealing with a legal theory that the reaccrual of this debt occurred by virtue of the plain language of the declaration?
Actually, I agree with Your Honor. We don't need to get into admissibility. The three key exhibits, which back up the allegation concerning the claim under the declaration in the complaint, are all attached to the complaint.
But you realize, of course, that does not mean that it's in the evidentiary record of the court. It clearly is not in the evidentiary record of the court if you're dealing with an ori tenens hearing. So I wonder if we're scrambling the argument way too much, because you can still have a plea and bar on a theory on the plea and bar purely on the pleadings, in which case we treat the exhibits the way we would a demur.
That is correct. And because of the fact that the claim under the declaration itself is incorporated under the rule into the pleading, then, and you don't need any witness testimony regarding that, then it should be treated, that particular claim should be treated as if it were a claim on the pleadings. And that's I think you are correct that we may have scrambled the argument up too much. Because when you come down to it, you have to look at the burden of proof here, Mr. Peterson's burden of proof. Is it sufficient to simply put into evidence the memoranda of liens that were filed in 2006? Well, no, because that doesn't meet the terms of the claim under the declaration. So he would, no defense was ever made to that. The only defense is, well, the claim under the declaration is also barred by the 3-year statute of limitations, because the only thing, according to Mr. Peterson, that you can do is file a lien. And the lien was filed, no question about it, in 2006. And so, you know, the statute of limitations has run. Now, what this does is it ignores Virginia law on this subject. And that is, under the Lackland case, which the court is familiar with, when the statute of limitations runs, let's assume here that the statute of limitations ran on the original claim for unpaid assessments in 2009. Well, what is then the status of the debt? According to the ruling of the court in the Lackland case, it is settled, I'm quoting from the decision, it is settled in this state that the running of the statute of limitations merely bars the creditor's remedy but does not extinguish the debt. This was followed in a series of cases, which we have recited in our brief.
Once again, Mr. Mays, I'm sorry, but wouldn't the right answer under your argument not be for us to decide an issue that the trial court has not yet decided, but simply to remand it to be cited in the first instance? We throw around the statement, and it's pretty intentional. We're not a court of first view. We're a court of review. So under your best theory, the trial judge did not address this issue. We would simply remand it for that purpose. Am I oversimplifying this case?
Your Honor, if the court wishes to remand it for further ruling by the trial court, the association would be perfectly happy. And I don't want to overcomplicate it. I am simply saying that as a matter of law, it's almost grounds for a summary judgment. The debt was still alive and therefore could be asserted under the provision in the declaration. It was still an unpaid debt for assessments that arose out of maintenance and repair of common elements and was payable upon the transfer or conveyance of the units. And so whether this court decides that issue or it is remanded for the trial court to decide that issue, we are content with that. Does that answer your question, Judge?
It does. Thank you very much.
I see my time is approaching. I reserve my time for rebuttal and I will conclude. We ask that the court either remand the case or do as we have suggested in our brief, even if I've perhaps overstated it. But if the court is of a mind to remand the case, then that would be fine. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Mays. You have 3 minutes and 13 seconds for rebuttal. Mr. Little.
May it please the court. I'm Dave Lytell representing the appellee, Joel Peterson. I would like to go directly to this question of incorporation of facts in the pleadings under Rule 1:4I. Clearly, that rule does state that the mention of a document would incorporate that into the pleadings, that document. But it does not say that that document would then be either admissible or have evidentiary status in a hearing. And the key point I would like the court to consider is when we're talking about a demurrer, of course, the facts are all assumed to be true for purposes of testing the legal sufficiency. And that's key, testing legal sufficiency. In a plea and bar, by definition, the court is engaging in some degree of fact finding. So
can I interrupt you there, counsel? That last statement, I have to question, because our cases on plea and bar are actually quite clear. They don't synthesize each other very well, but they're pretty clear. You can do a plea and bar entirely on the pleadings. A defendant can come in and say, look, I'll assume arguendo every single thing in this document is correct, including the attachments. I still win for this legal reason. Or you can do a plea and bar based upon contested facts and ore tenens. And our appellate review, of course, changes depending on what happens. But in your case, you had ore tenens, but you also had theories that were being asserted based entirely on the pleadings. And you're obviously right that the exhibits to a pleading are not exhibits in the evidentiary proceeding unless they were properly admitted, and they weren't in this case. But I just wonder if we're circling around a very simple proposition. The trial court made no decision on the issue because he believed he needed to hear these documents as evidence when the plea and bar rules permit him to look at the pleadings and the exhibits. So what am I missing here?
Your Honor, with respect, I don't know. I don't believe that under Virginia law there is a plea and bar rule that says that the documents would be considered as having any evidentiary status. And I think you touched on this earlier.
But I'm not saying that. I apologize if I'm confusing things. Let's assume for the sake of argument, you're absolutely right. A lawyer can't throw a binder up at the trial judge and say, these are my exhibits. Please put them in there and forget to do it. But you can do a plea and bar as a defendant and say, I see the complaint and I see the exhibits incorporated into the complaint and I have a dispositive affirmative defense and I can win it. So the issue we're talking about, which is the declaration cause of action versus the lien statute of limitations, is a pure legal question. Now, the trial court didn't rule upon it, but the question is, should we send it back and have the trial court rule upon it?
Justice Kelsey, I would suggest that because a plea and bar is defined as a motion, a plea in which there is a discrete finding of fact the court needs to make. And I would say that in a plea and bar, in any plea and bar for the statute of limitations, the court must make factual findings about accrual of the cause of action and a couple of, and depending on how complex it is, other facts that would then make it a pronouncement about the permit a pronouncement about whether the plea is to be sustained.
But your legal argument, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that 5579.84D, which is the 3-year statute governing liens that secure this underlying cause of action, is the superseding statute that eliminates the accrual of a cause of action based upon a breach of the declaration. So their legal argument is no, they're two completely different concepts.
I lost audio, Your Honor. Sorry.
Can you still hear me?
I can hear you now. Sorry, lost for a moment.
Okay, so the argument that the plaintiff is making is no, the lien statute is a security device. It is a remedy. It is not a cause of action. Just like a mechanics lien, it's not a cause of action. It's just a remedy for an underlying cause of action. And so their argument is that there's a cause of action, an accrual that depends upon a breach of the declaration. There's no facts that need to be determined to see if that's right. And it's all in the pleadings, and the trial judge refused to look at it.
And here's what I would say in response. And that is that what the association is asking this court to do is to make a finding that for purposes of a plea and bar, which does entail some degree of fact finding, the mere inclusion of facts or documents in a pleading gives them evidentiary status for the court to then make a fact finding that would be the basis of the plea and bar. And this
this will be my last question on the topic. What authority do you have that says a plea and bar by definition necessarily presupposes a fact-finding exercise by a trial court?
My authority would be the numerous cases that state the proposition from this court that a plea and bar reduces the issues to a discrete finding of fact that would operate as a bar to the action. I think that's an established principle that defines a plea and bar as distinct from anything, a demurrer that's merely testing legal sufficiency. So I would just
rely on a single fact can be a disputed single fact, or it can be an alleged fact. And here the alleged fact is a declaration breach that's incorporated as an exhibit to the complaint.
Correct. And I just would say that I think it's a very fine line, but when you reflect on the fact that a demurrer and we you know, is a wholly different type of proceeding, as obviously you know, but the implications of a ruling in this case that those documents had evidentiary status and would form the basis for the trial court to rule on the plea and bar merely because they were attached to the pleadings would, I believe, for the first time in Virginia, would give evidentiary status, not just incorporation into pleadings, but evidentiary status to something merely by dint of it being attached to a pleading or included in a pleading. And I do think that it's illusory because in so many cases, these facts are absolutely obvious. The date of an accident, not disputed. The date of filing, not disputed. But when you get into other, and in this particular case, you know, the trial judge ruled at the outset of the hearing, nothing will be admitted under, he was viewing the circumstances as they were arising. We're talking about hundreds of pages of documents. And I believe, as noted in my brief, he made what would be properly deemed a discretionary determination, and that he would only admit documents at the hearing as they were submitted, and for logical, reasonable reason that there were lots and lots of documents. And he made that ruling. And my argument, Your Honor, would be that this ruling was entirely consistent with the law. There actually aren't any cases that would support the plaintiff's position.
Yes. Have he answered your question, Justice Kelsey?
Yes, thank you.
Counsel, let me make sure I understand your argument. You would agree with us that a plea and bar can be decided on the pleadings with no evidence? Or is that where we're having the disagreement?
I would say not if the facts in the pleadings are objected to or disputed in any way. So most often this is done. There's simply no question about the facts that would be operative. But in any case where there's more evidence that may be disputed, then I don't believe, and if the party in supporting the plea objects or does not agree with the evidence as stated in the pleadings, or it is simply not admitted, as in this case, I don't believe that the issue can be decided in that circumstance. And again, it so rarely comes up because so almost universally the facts that are pertinent are obvious and not disputed. But in this case, it's a little different.
Do we have any case that stands for that proposition?
Your Honor, only the cases that are cited on brief, which what they say is basically they state it as an either or, either can be heard on the pleadings or by evidence developed. Mm-hmm. And there is one opinion from this court that states, that says, I'll just cite it briefly. It says, when an issue is decided by the circuit court on demur, we accept as true the facts alleged by the plaintiff, who is entitled to the benefit of all reasonable inferences that may be drawn from them. We also accept plaintiff's allegations as true when the circuit court takes no evidence on the plea and bar. So it's by implication, and this is a decision from this court, it's called Station Number 2 versus Lynch, a 2010 opinion. Certainly by implication, that language is saying that when the circuit court does take evidence on the plea and bar, it does not take the truth of the plaintiff's assertions as in the pleadings as established.
So your argument seems to be that it is either or all or nothing. It is either a hearing where evidence is taken or it is a hearing on the pleadings, but it can't be a hybrid, some issues on the pleading and some by evidence?
I believe that's true. Your Honor, I believe that is the way this must be viewed, because again, if this court were to rule that on a plea and bar the plaintiff can rely on anything asserted in the pleadings, that ultimately will require the court to make findings of fact based on something merely because those facts were included in the pleadings. And that's why we in this context of a demur, it's all very different. It's merely testing legal sufficiency. I hope that answers your question. I will,
thank you.
If it's all right with the court, I will just briefly touch on some other subjects.
Let me ask you this. How could you obtain a plea and bar concerning your claim regarding this declaration without the declaration being considered by the court? I mean, and you have the burden of proving that this declaration is barred. So it seems like to me it hurts you if this is not in evidence, because you can't possibly win if it's not.
Your Honor, we established by evidence and by an exhibit the date of the filing of the memorandum of lien, which was the accrual date. So that's the date when the association...
Can I stop you right there? Because my understanding is they're saying, okay, you've got a lien, but there's also an additional cause of action we have based upon a declaration that your client was a party to, which says that he's assuming a debt upon the purchase of the property. So how does your plea and bar that cause of action at all?
Because as a legal matter, the lien and the obligation to pay these assessments was extinguished by operation of law 36 months after the filing of that lien memorandum as a legal matter. And therefore, what's in the declaration
Well, isn't the problem that you have then that the court didn't make that ruling? The court says, I'm going to grant a plea and bar concerning this because I don't have the declaration in front of me. It's not because of the legal argument you're making concerning the lien. He says it's because I don't have enough information to rule on this particular claim.
And I believe what the court either explicitly stated or certainly implicitly found in its opinion was that that the defendant, Mr. Peterson, had met his burden on by establishing the accrual date, as we did with exhibits that we placed into evidence. And therefore, it was up to the plaintiff at that point to come up with an argument that would oppose that. And the only basis would be a document that was not entered into evidence. So I think that we did maintain our, meet the burden of proof by getting the simple facts, which we believe is operative, which is the accrual date, and then the applicable statutes of limitations and legal principles under the Condominium Act were sufficient with that fact alone to establish that the plea should be granted, which is what the trial court found. So I understand the court's issue there with the document, but again, I think the burden was met. The operation of law under any theory, whether it's contract or the Condominium Act, extinguished those claims long before the action was filed. So I hope that that answers the court's question. I would just note, of course, the language that the court has set forth in previous opinions regarding statutes of limitations is quite absolute and stringent in that any determination of a statute of limitations issue must be deemed that the court should enforce the statute unless it is absolutely clear that it should not. And there is some...
But counsel, the claim here is not a claim to enforce a lien. The statute says no suit to enforce any lien, dot, dot, dot. So it's not a lien case. I'm struggling. Either I'm badly mistaken or there's some Venn diagrams that have been mixed up here, but there's not a claim on a lien. So why does the lien statute of limitations apply at all?
Because the lien itself is a creature of the statute, Your Honor.
I'm with you. I completely agree with you on that, but that's not the claim that's being asserted. It's just a straight up cause of action based upon the declaration, unprotected by any security device like a statutory lien.
Well, I misspoke. The obligation itself is purely a creature of the statute. The opinions of this court have established that all of condominium law is a creature of statute, and therefore the obligation itself was a creature of the statute and was extinguished, I would argue.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think you're over by 8 seconds, Mr. Lytell, so your time is up. Thank you very much. You have 3 minutes and 13 seconds for rebuttal, Mr. Mays.
Thank you, Your Honor. As I understand the argument that was just made, it's that the association only has rights under the act, not under the declaration, and it's just plainly wrong. As Justice Kelsey has just pointed out, this is not a lien case at this point. There was in the complaint a claim under the lien that the lien still existed, and this was non-suited on the morning of the hearing. The claim that's being made under the declaration is just a contract claim. The contract governing all owners in the condominium. The association always can do one of two things, or it can do both. It can either file a memorandum of lien and enforce it within 36 months, or it can file an action at law for violation of either the act or the condominium instruments. Virginia Code Section 50 resolves this. 55.1-1966G says this: nothing in this section shall be construed to prohibit actions at law to recover sums for which subsection A creates a lien, maintainable pursuant to 55.1-1915, which is for violations of either the condominium instruments or the Condominium Act. Also, there is an argument being made here that somehow this provision in the declaration is somehow void, or it constitutes some kind of legislative overreaching. That is not the case. Reliance is on the Gilman case. First of all, the Gilman case is factually distinguishable. And after the Gilman case, the General Assembly amended a section of the Condominium Act to...
It looks like Mr. Mays lost his contact with us. You're back with us, Mr. Mays?
Can you hear me, Your Honor?
We can hear you, and we'll restart the clock. Go ahead with your argument.
My argument is that owners associations and the executive board of owners associations have a wide degree of latitude after the decision in the Gilman case. Both the 55.1-1959, which was what Gilman was about, and 55.1-1956, which is about common elements, which is precisely what this case is about, state in their final section, this section shall not be construed to prohibit the grant by the condominium instruments of other powers and responsibilities to the unit owners association or its executive board. So the declaration provision that says if there are unpaid assessments,
Mr. Mays,
transfer them, it's valid. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Council will be in touch with you soon. Thank you very much for your arguments.
Thank you.
Ms. Clerk, please call the next case.